we're going to discuss the classic question that we've all been asking ourselves for many, many years. Can I choose my baby's gender? And you think this is a joke, I was reading an article about a celebrity who chose her baby's gender. This is about, I'm going to get this right. Hold on. Chrissy Teigen. Did I get that? She's married to John Legend. John Legend, excuse me, I meant to say. And I'm sleeping well. And they chose. Now, apparently, I learned because we had a similar discussion last night with the Shear, the group. And apparently, it turns out that was true. I just read this article, but that was true not of their current baby, which is a male, but their first baby. Or she's now expecting number two. Mm-hmm. 2 years ago, apparently, when they had their first child. You know how in the Jewish community, Ayin Hara, so we don't always announce the gender beforehand, but in the secular community, it's not uncommon to announce, you know, we're expecting a boy or we're expecting a girl.
Reveal
parties, right? So instead of a reveal party in which talking about the gender that they discover, that they learn the child will have, instead they made an announcement about the gender that they had chosen for their child. I kid you not. You can go back 2 years and read the article. And they said, we have chosen to give birth to a girl. How does that work?
Yeah,
They chose a female.
They had in vitro and
that is exactly what it is.
Sorry, was that not a case where the wife had infertility issues as well?
I have to confess that I know more about the Rambam or even now about the Duchess of Alba than I think I know about Chrissy Teigen. I'm going to put it out there, full disclosure. I believe you.
I don't know myself, but I think it may have.
It's entirely possible, and I don't mean to certainly pass judgment at all. All I mean to say is that it's in the news, and that it's a real possibility. And it became a real possibility, a real acute sort of, or a very serious option, starting about 12 years ago or so. And around that time, there was an article that was published by CNN.com, which I gave you over here, which essentially reviewed what the issues are and what the background is. So it reads as follows. Gender selection a reality, but is it ethical? Okay, so apparently it's a reality. So what's going on over here? So this is about more of an everyday couple. People like me and you, Matthew and Beth Mandalesi, told their doctor that they would be happy with a boy or a girl, but wondered if there was a way to increase the odds that it would be a boy. Okay, so we all know people like that. Really, I don't care, but I kind of would prefer this way. But I really don't care. So they're sort of like that. We all know people like that.
Passive aggressive IBS.
Right, exactly, right? That's it. That's exactly right. So that's what they... well diagnosed. And that's exactly what it was. We had a debate last night whether or not... You know, we know that in past eras in history, certainly people would prefer a boy. Is that still true in America today? Do you think if you took an honest-to-goodness poll, first child, I don't mean after you've tried and haven't succeeded, do you think that people would have a gender preference?
Absolutely.
First
Americans
child,
across
yes.
the country.
Yeah.
First child.
They have a preference just because that's what they want. Not because
what
of
do they want?
Societal norms, I'm saying. Like some people just want girls.
Right, but if you did an average, if you took... I'm saying if you did a study across the board, I don't mean individual people.
I would still say boy.
Depends on the circle.
I would say like across the board, America, like first child.
Yeah.
I would still say boy.
Is there now in the Jewish community there are unique?
Yeah,
either opportunities.
It's a boy.
With respect to the Shalom Zachar, which is a wonderful celebration, but especially on late summer nights. Okay, Shalom Zachar. Let me tell you, I'm not sure that that's a reason to or not to. Okay, it's what. Okay, and I'm not even. I don't want to elaborate that. It's nice to have a l'chaim, but it's exhausting.
Right.
After a long week. So yes. So some people, you know, it's exciting. I mean, you have Shalom Zachar and the bris, and if it's the first one and it's a natural birth and there are no Kohanim or Levim in the picture, then you even have the Pidyon Haben. Right? And other people are like, I'll be more than happy to have my girl and we'll make a Kiddush in 3 months, okay? And we'll Chef Daniel Israel, okay? That was your choice. That's your husband. That was, as we call it, financial professional investment, if I understood it correctly. But be that as it may, the right. So that's it's interesting. So still a boy.
Is there like a statistic on this?
I have not.
How did it come out last night? What did people?
people also thought boy. First they said in the Jewish community, and then they thought more generally as well. So
I think Don put
down. Scott, you can go if you want to go check it out. Yeah. Sure. You can then you can go to the construction site and you can talk to them as well.
Poll.
You are?
Take a poll.
I was gonna say ask them to hold off on the drilling for a few moments. Anyhow.
I just wanted to add, it's really not funny because, for example, in India.
You're a prophet.
Yeah.
Did you cheat, Emily? I don't believe you. That was okay. Don't read it yet. We're gonna get there. Okay. Just know that Emily has Ruach HaKodesh or Nevuah or some combination of the two. 5 years later. Okay. So that was what they said. 5 years later, they are the parents of two boys, Antonio and Angelo. Okay. So their wish came true. The Manglesi family is part of a growing trend called family balancing. Okay? Family balancing. If there's ever a euphemism, okay, that was it. That allows couples, of course, you know, they're not necessarily a balanced family. It allows couples to choose their baby's gender, fertility doctors around the country say. And this is back in 2005. A few years ago, I had a couple of clients asking every month, now it's at least 2 or 3 weeks, asking seriously about it, said Dr. Kevin Wizzo of the Florida Institute of Reproductive Medicine. There are 3 methods of gender selection. The cost, technology, and price vary. The first and oldest type is sperm separation, which has been used since the 1970s. The method that Matthew Mendelessi chose gave them about a 60% chance of having a boy, according to their fertility doctor. So, right, which is up from, what, 49.9-something percent, right? So it's not a dramatic, right? The odds are that they wouldn't have necessarily both had boys, but that's, or had both births be boys. But that was the older one. That's what they use. A sample of Matthew's sperm was spun in a centrifuge. The spinning separates the Y sperm that creates a boy from the X sperm that creates a girl. The Y sperm was used to fertilize Beth's egg. The couple paid $250 in addition to the cost of an in vitro fertilization procedure. The average sperm sorting costs $400 to $600 today, Winslow said. Now, just to say, $250 is a relatively inexpensive amount for this. But what it doesn't say in this article is that IVF in America is prohibitively expensive. We're talking about $15,000 to $20,000 per cycle. Right? And it's something like, right, or even more, and it's something like 15 to 20% of a success rate per cycle. And that's with multiple embryos implanted. So
it's also, I've heard, a very difficult thing to go through. So I'm surprised that people want to do it.
Well, they didn't really care if it was a boy or a girl, but they kind of really wanted a boy.
So we're
going to see that. It's not uncommon. We're seeing in this article there are people who are choosing IVF just so that they can choose the gender. As opposed to, we have fertility issues or whatever, we have to go through IVF for whatever independent reason, and then once we're there, we're going to utilize a methodology that's going to allow me to choose the gender. So that's,
you're already buying a car. Why don't you get XYZ?
Like we call that designer babies.
Right. And then it becomes...
Well,
really
when you read further in this article, though, it does introduce a little more serious considerations.
Absolutely. So let's see. So that's what they did. That's not what's done nowadays. A more sophisticated type of sperm sorting is based on staining and separating sperm. Microsort, which remains a leader in the field, from the Genetics and IVF Institute of Fairfax, Virginia, has been in clinical trials since 1995. Went to get approval from the Food and Drug Administration, claimed 76% accuracy for boys and the 91% accuracy for girls. I do not know why there is such a discrepancy in the technology, at least as it was back in 2005, but I'm open to anyone. Maybe Paya would know. We can ask her, but that's interesting. Right now, couples are enlisting in the trial and paying around $2,500 to this unapproved technology. I guess is it legal?
It's
unapproved. Is it legal? I was wondering that myself.
It's experimental.
Oh, experimental. Insurance isn't covering it, but it's not illegal.
There's probably risks involved.
They're probably in clinical trials.
They're probably in clinical. It's illegal to do it.
There's no way that someone as prominent as Microsort would be caught doing something illegal.
So they're doing clinical
I'm sure they're doing
trials.
Clinical trials. It just hasn't been. At that time. Well, we're not using this anymore. We barely use this anymore anyway, because we'll see in a moment that there's PGD, which we'll define, and that's going to be the one that's become all the rage. And for a very simple reason, because you'll see in a moment. Right? The newest, in 2005, and most controversial method is called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, or PGD, and is based on embryo examination. In other words, we're not creating a gender, We're just identifying the gender that's already present in a particular embryo in a petri dish. You're testing the genetic composition of a particular embryo.
But what else are you testing it for?
Oh, you can test for all sorts of things.
That's right. That's
what
it goes on to
test.
That's
it.
Yeah, but that's what it goes on to talk about.
Well, that's right. That's right. You can test all sorts of genetic. You can test its genome pretty much. So, right, exactly. So this method, that's why it was developed. This method requires in vitro fertilization. It's 99% effective. Okay, and this is back in 2005. Okay, so now it's all but 100% effective. Not in terms of bearing children, but I mean in terms of the genetic testing itself. Okay, it costs up to $19,000. I think it's somewhat less than that now, but still expensive. So I think it's like $10,000 or something like that, but I haven't checked recently. So Dr. Jeffrey Steinberg of the Fertility Institute, whose clinics in Los Angeles, California, Las Vegas, Nevada, and Mexico, provides sex selection through various methods, including PGD. PGD, as you guys said, was first developed and is used primarily to find genetic mutations linked to about 200 genetic diseases, such as Tay-Sachs and cystic fibrosis. Okay, so those are obviously extremely severe genetic disorders. And so the thinking is that,
absolutely,
right, if you've got, sure, let's say it's a recessive gene, and we know that both parents are carriers, and there's a 1 out of 4 chance in the simplest case, right, your Punnett square, that the child will be born with, right, with such a mortal disease. So then it makes good sense, now that we have the technology, to ensure, to test. So if we have, let's say, 10 embryos from a woman that we take out and we put in the petri dish and we fertilize them, and we can find that 7 out of the 10 are non-Tay-Sachs babies, even if they're carriers, but that means those are the ones that obviously we're going to want to implant rather than, God forbid, the Tay-Sachs ones. And that's a very sensible medical reason to do this, and that's a lot better than the nightmarish suffering that so many people have unfortunately undergone for so many years. That makes good sense. Eggs are taken from the woman and fertilized with sperm to form an embryo. Doctors then take one cell out to analyze its DNA. The healthy embryos are selected, and then female or male embryos can be chosen because it's the same test that can tell you the gender. Some ethicists and doctors say they are troubled with PGD being used for elective non-medical reasons. Dr. Mark Hughes, a pioneer in PGD and director of the Michigan-based Genesis Genetics Institute, they're very from there, says that 70% of patients who are using PGD for gender selection wouldn't have needed in vitro fertilization in the first place. Is that a stunning statistic?
They're going through this process.
Well, they're well. You used to say rich people? You say rich people?
I think people who have money, not in a bad way, money, I
think,
for them.
Right.
And they're willing to do it. Like, if someone who doesn't have the money would be like, well, it is what we'll get what we get.
Yeah, for sure. By the way, I know that IVF is covered in Israel, and I want to say, and PGD in particular cases. Yeah, fertility. Fertility OLM or fertility refugees, they call them. Like tuition refugees? Yeah. She was tuition refugees? Fertility refugees. Okay, so I heard that it's covered for legitimate medical reasons, the PGD, and I don't know if this is true for sure, we have to check this out. I heard that if you have 3 children and they're all the same gender and you want the other gender, that they will cover it on the fourth child. I don't know for sure if that is true. I was told that. It's unverified information.
That's a creepy thing. As an American, if you go to Israel, the price to have it done, like, we have friends, unfortunately, who could not have children on their own, and they went to Israel, and the price is 1/4 of what it is here. Mm-hmm. And it works. It worked there for them, but it's like 1/4 the price.
Right.
To have
well, it's covered by. It's covered by.
But as an American, they were able to. They had to pay out of pocket.
They had to pay out of pocket. In other words, for Israelis, it's covered. It's fully covered or almost fully covered.
It's covered, but it's significantly cheaper.
It's like,
what's the cost?
It's significantly cheaper, but you're still paying a lot, right? But you're
right.
For some people, it works. They also wanted to be
for sure, for sure. But you're saying they still charge the Americans significantly more than the Israelis. So it's kind of,
they have to pay full fare.
It's kind of like taking a taxi.
It's like so much
less. Are you American? 80 shekel, 100 shekel. Everyone pays 100 shekel.
Is a third of what it is here. So it's just, it's the same price for Israelis. It's just not covered by a coupon.
Right, yeah, exactly. That's right. Now, I don't know all the details in Israel. Like, at a certain point, it may no longer be covered. And again, I'm not certain about this point with the number of children. Although, for halachic reasons, we're going to come back to this in a few minutes, you could make that argument. Right, what's the halachic argument for another child, for a child of the opposite gender, not just your pru revu, right? So there's a mitzvah. The first mitzvah in the Torah is to be fruitful and multiply. Pru revu. There's a debate in the Mishnah already, in Masechet Yevamot. Beit Shammai says you fulfill the mitzvah of pru revu with two boys. We try not to publicize that, but too little, too late now. We don't paskin that way.
Two girls?
What?
Two boys.
No, no one says two girls, please. Okay. Just curious. Now, we haven't found that opinion. But we don't paskin that way. Beit Hillel holds a boy and a girl. That's how we accept. That's what all the Rishonim say, all the medieval commentators. That's what the Rambam paskins in his Mishneh Torah. That's what the Shulchan Aruch codifies, and that's the accepted halacha. And so there are all sorts of implications to that if a couple is trying to, you know, at a certain point, and, you know, that there's a whole discussion about that. By the way, we paskin that the next generation can actually fulfill the mitzvah for the previous generation. Okay? So I hope you're taking notes on this. Okay, so God willing, Mishat Tova Mitzacha. And I can tell you this from personal experience. Sorry to make this awkward for anyone in the room. From personal experience, because I am the oldest of four boys. My wife is the oldest of five girls.
Oh, in the halakha.
Okay? So Sinansky's meet the Werbers. We tried all the shidduchim across the board. No such luck. And my youngest brother just got engaged. So it's not looking good, but we tried. It was quite the culture gap. I mean, when I came for Shabbat, I remember one time I'm sitting next to my future father-in-law, and Tova and her sisters are debating the colors for the wedding. So we got married in late November, and
wait, you didn't have a say in this?
Right, you laugh for good reason. Yeah, tongue in cheek. So Tova likes bright colors, but we were getting married in late November, so Thanksgiving weekend wedding. So Tova wanted pink, and her sisters said, well, that's not seasonally appropriate. And back and forth they went, and finally her sister exclaims, I am not getting dressed up like a piece of bubble gum for your wedding. This is like it, you know, exploded. And I'm like sitting there stunned, you know, like I had never seen an argument like this around my Shabbos table, you know. So my father-in-law turns to me, he's like, I'm coming to your parents' next Shabbos. I was like, it was worth it, right?
What color was the wedding?
What? The color one, thank you very much. I think they were pink at a Huba's wedding, and Tova's, I don't remember. I think like somewhere in Neat, it was like...
George had the same experience.
Well, I forget exactly. It was like Azure or something like that. I don't remember the exact... Not that I would remember, sadly.
I don't know if we're allowed to read ahead, but...
Yeah, you are, because I'm just... Yeah,
storytelling. I'm just finding it so interesting, the next to the last line.
Yeah, go ahead.
It probably isn't an ethically good thing to do, because you're creating embryos when you don't know...
Let's come back to that in a moment. Yeah, the question of discarding embryos.
Right. Yeah.
Oh, let's talk about that in a moment. I just want to finish the Pur Revu point, and then I'm going to come to that. So the Pur Revu point goes as follows. We accept that, according to Halacha, as we said, that it's one boy, one girl. What I was going to say is that the next generation, if you have the opposite gender, can fulfill it, we accept in Halacha, for the previous generation. So in other words, what I was saying is when Tova and I had our first as a boy, Betzal is 11 years old, when Betzal was born, we helped to fulfill Pur Revu for my in-laws, who had previously only had girls, and now we filled it in.
Oh.
And then when my daughter, my oldest daughter was born, when Moriah was born, I felt my parents, and it was two for the price of one, because we fulfilled Pru Revu at the same time, because we had a boy and we had a girl, and the girl helped to fulfill the mitzvah for my parents. So it was like a clean sweep. So I like this. I like to remind my parents and in-laws just how much they owe us, which they already know because they have grandchildren.
Two boys does fulfill.
No, we do not accept that in halacha. Beit Shammai says that. We reject that as a matter of halacha. We follow Beit Hillel. No, you just apply pressure. No. Okay, that's what I'm trying to say. Anyhow, when the time comes. Anyhow, so Pruvu is relevant, or come back to this halachically, because maybe you can make the argument that according to halachic perspective, from a secular perspective, you might say that the, you know, it's just a question of your desire to have boys, girls, whatever. That's just voluntary. That's just preferential. It's just what you want. But here, halachically, there might be a stronger argument to permit PGD to fulfill Pruvu, you might argue.
You're not supposed to put yourself through
unnecessary
procedures.
That's right.
So.
You could definitely say like Ruth as well, and so the debate goes. So that's a current subject of debate. So that's one halachic issue that's definitely relevant. Now another halachic issue, as you say, keep on reading, right? Which is what we just went out, which is that, well, what about the question of discarding embryos, right? And this became a big issue, not just here, but back in the Bush era days, if anyone remembers, when talking about embryonic stem cell research, right? This was a big bioethics debate about discarding embryos. President Bush at the time was more beholden to conservative Christian halachic authorities, as it were, right? So they were more concerned about this. In halacha, what we generally say is this. There's a minority opinion that says it's absolutely prohibited to discard embryos under placenta. It's like an abortion.
Really?
There is a minority view. That is not the generally accepted halachic position. Generally accepted halachic position is that we may discard the embryos, but with care and caution and with a sense of reverence. So indirectly, for example, you don't like flush it down the toilet or something like that. You just, you know, turn off the incubator or something like that and allow them to die of their own accord and then discard them in a respectful fashion. You know, it doesn't have to be buried in a cemetery or fully,
as
but
as a matter of fact, respectful. I don't know the medical fact, but very early on, it's not even an embryo. What do they call it? A zygote?
What? It's a zygote. Well, you're saying in general.
In general,
yeah.
When does the combined sperm egg become an embryo? And my guess is that it's later.
That's much later.
At that point, yeah. So in the Petri dish, it's usually up to 5 days, and there are 32 to 64 undifferentiated cells, and that's part of the reason that the testing actually works, because they're undifferentiated, so you can really pull out what you need in terms of the genetic materials. So, yeah, one is it doesn't have in any way resemblance of life as we know it. And the other piece, though, is that it's not implanted into a woman. Now, in the age of artificial wombs, it becomes more complicated. You can't fully develop a baby in a Petri dish, obviously. But give us 30 years and maybe we will be able to. So, you know, would that change the definition of life? Because now this has the potential in its current state without being implanted into a woman's body in order to develop into life. Ruth?
Well, I was going to say, sorry to interrupt you.
No.
Usually I think they don't discard them at that stage though, because they're keeping them in case the couple needs them, or it tends to be held for long, so it would probably be past the 5 days. I mean, they wouldn't be necessarily discarding them when they were.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they'd be holding them and seeing if they need them, and then at some much
That's
later
right.
stage they have to discard them.
Yeah.
Banking.
Yeah.
So
no, we definitely would bank them if we can, for sure. We wouldn't discard them summarily, but there comes a point which.
So it probably would be an embryo, is my point, at that point, because it would have developed at that point.
No, but you keep them frozen in the Petri dish for as long as you need, and then eventually, if the woman outgrows it, she can donate it to someone else, but there is all sorts of other complications, and it's more commonly discarded at a certain point. No, I don't think so. They're freezing it at that same. Yeah.
This is a little tangential, but what about not discarding them but using it for research? What is the position on that?
So there's, again, a debate about that. But most post-com say that embryonic stem cell research is permissible against the Catholic position, which is much more hardline on abortion in general, and that includes this as well. Whether or not embryonic stem cell research has delivered the medical promise that it once was considered to hold is a separate issue. It's not so clear that it really has that potential. Okay, and Emily, this is for you. Return to your prophecy. So these are some of the other general ethical concerns. In China now, there are 117 boys for every 100 girls. Okay, that's a matter, a function of law, right? And what's happening there, as in India, is abortions very often.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Because you can only have one child, and...
That's changed, though.
What? Yes, that I know. But... But so between two now.
In China,
it's two now, right? But still. In parts of northern India, it's 140 boys for every 100 girls, says Michael Sandel, a Harvard University professor, member of the President Council on Bioethics, and I believe what they do is they abort.
Yeah, I think so.
They test, and then they abort. Because culturally, there's no, it's not a legal matter in India, it's, I think, a cultural matter.
Yeah, people are, women, I read a novel once, my woman escaped from India so she could have her baby girl. She didn't want to have an abortion.
Right. And it was considered shameful.
Yes, yeah. Shameful to do that.
It's shameful not to abort a girl.
Yes,
and it's a religious. It's considered religiously preferred. Like, where is it? What's the?
I don't know the details.
It's so impractical.
It's awful, and no one could have predicted the gender imbalance that was going to come in future generations. We have all these men and.
Well, I mean, you're creating a shidduch crisis. I mean, right? Time, yeah, that's it. You never heard of the Indian shidduch crisis before? Right, here it is. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But in China, they would give the girls up for adoption, which is why there was a creative...
Right,
when there was so many Chinese girls.
Oh,
right.
Yeah.
Right. That were adopted.
Yeah,
and so this was in order. It wasn't just that because there was a cultural preference, there was a need to correct.
Ship them out. Right.
There's
get
a need
rid
to.
Of them they're not helpful to our society, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh. Yeah, so that's it. So there's a concern, in other words, about in America or other Western countries about a similar thing, especially most people prefer boys still, if that's true. On the whole in America or in Europe, etc., especially in Europe where there's so few children being born also, so you know, the gender imbalances becomes a bigger issue. Apparently, I didn't hear her talk, but those who heard Sivan Rav Meir over the course of Shabbat, I understand that she mentioned that in Europe, almost none of the world leaders, if any, have children of their own. Right? New Zealand was an exception, but that's last time I checked, it's not European.
Because Theresa May cannot have children.
Was that
an arrival once attacked her for it and said you don't have children and it was very hurtful, so that's the only reason I know, because she
never know.
Not
you actually never know, and that's why we have the Ish Tikva Fertility Awareness Shabbat, because you know you always have to be mindful. Well said, thank you. But either way, you can imagine that this would create a tremendous imbalance. Didn't they just change the law in America? About senators nursing on the floor.
Yes, they did.
Oh,
yeah,
they just passed it.
They just passed it.
That you could nurse on
what's
the floor.
What's her name?
Not nurse. Bring a baby on the floor.
And then they actually had to also
they said nurse.
Nurse on the floor
they
as well.
To bring a baby
included,
and not
they
feed them. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, they had to actually stipulate.
Because you had to be there for a certain amount of time
right.
Is the point.
So,
she couldn't just walk in for the vote and then just
right.
Step
well,
out. It was part of the debate.
One, that any adult, any senator was allowed to bring a child under the age of two.
Under two. I saw that.
Oh,
I thought it was two.
It's two.
Okay.
And then you also have to stipulate that you have to be able to nurse on the floor.
Right.
But she is not nursing the baby, but they stipulated that in future you could be allowed to nurse on the floor.
To be able to feed the baby.
And because the only reason they had to stipulate that is
well,
because
and if
she's
that's
part
how you're feeding the baby.
And she lost both of her legs in Afghanistan or Iraq.
Yeah.
And because she can't, normally if you have an injury or you're sick, they have you go to the closet. There's a beautiful cloak room. But because her wheelchair can't get her there, she has to. She'd have to go through the floor to climb the stair, whatever it is. So, and because she's a vet, she can't get there. So they had to make this law. They had to change the law for her.
Mm.
Wow, what a force of change!
Then babies allowed to wear a head covering, which not allowed to cover your head, listen, and could be barefoot.
Yes, because those are the two rules.
Because we thought that those laws might apply to.
Right, exactly. They were very mitu yuck, and the rules.
We have Josh Shapiro was here on Sunday, so you can get this CLE program that we had. So he said, "Summation of laws." So.
Clearly.
Yeah, that's it. He also said that you know he went to Akiva.
Yes.
So is anyone here there?
Yeah.
What?
We all know.
What? You were what? Yeah. So he said.
So did Jay Tapper.
We had this CLE program.
Yeah,
Attorney General
so
Joshua. And he said, what?
Jake Tapper, the...
Yes, that. Wow. America,
so
famously. And now infamously since his life. Anyhow, so, yes. And he also said that it's nice to be back in the gym where he used to dunk. Unclear if he was joking. Okay. All right. So, anyhow. All right. So, it concerns... It continues, but basically... I love the conclusion of this article. It's a little bit. It's a good time. Matthew and Beth, last two paragraphs. Matthew and Beth Mandelesi said they are happy with their decision. At the time we did it, we didn't really think about the ethical part, Matthew said. We've heard from both sides since then. If we had to do it all over again, we would do it again. Mm-hmm. So our job is to be thinking about the ethical part, about the ethical part, rather. So it's fascinating that they didn't. And the question is, so there are all sorts of debates in the general ethical community, but the question then becomes, what about from a halachic perspective? Are there unique factors that would be brought to bear from a halachic perspective, or are these just sort of general universal ethical questions, and a posek, a rabbi, a Jewish theologian or something like that would think about this in much the same way as a general ethicist? And that's the second question and final question that I want to consider for today. So I reproduce an article. We're not going to read the whole thing. We'll read a couple of small pieces, but you have it here. This is from is a selection from Tradition Magazine, which is our journal, which is the Journal of the Ecumenical Council of America. Joel Olowalski and Richard Grazi are both highly qualified to write this. Richard Grazi, I actually was, when we were in Einstein previously before we came to Philly, we were there together with his daughter. So I got to know her. She's wonderful. And he's a real mensch as well. He wrote a 500-some-odd page thick tome in about 10, 12 years ago on reproductive medicine and halacha. Mm-hmm. He is an REI, he's a reproductive endocrinologist, mm-hmm. and he has a tremendous expertise in this area. Of course, the challenge in writing a book on this topic is that you have to revise the book approximately once a month, or once a week, or once a day. So it's probably half outdated by this point, but he has real expertise. Joel Olowalski is a math teacher, so you might think him not to be qualified, but he indeed is, because he researches these kinds of topics quite broadly. He also has a book on women and halakha, those who are familiar. He's a very thoughtful individual, and he's also done a lot of work on medical ethics generally and fertility in particular. So they start the first couple of pages here, which we're not going to read, and they go through the general medical background, and then they come to some of the relevant parts from the halakhic perspective. They first raise on page 48 now, they raise a side issue, but of course is brought to bear here, which is the question of donor sperm. Donor sperm in halakha, surrogacy in general. And they point out in the second paragraph, there is, however, a vigorous debate among halakhic authorities regarding the use of donor gametes, especially donor sperm. In one view, donor sperm violates the exclusivity of marriage to such an extent that it should be rejected as too akin to adultery. So there's the question of if I take the sperm of another individual, of a man, and I insert it into a woman, is that considered to be a form of unity between the sperm donor and this woman? Right. That's a pretty surprising position. The basis that why would you say such a thing? That's not necessarily the majority position. Why would you say such a thing? Because the Gemara talks about this case of a woman who... Did we talk about this in the past? The woman who was impregnated in the bathhouse?
Oh, yeah.
Did we talk about that? I know it's been a while. It's before Pesach. Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's where this comes from, this whole issue. Okay? It's a very strange, you know, a seemingly unlikely kind of scenario. But there seems to be a concern that that somehow is relevant. So that some say that that's on the basis of that Gemara and Chagiga, that that's a form of adultery. And somehow that carries through, or at least the way that they take that Gemara. It's not clear that that's the proper conclusion. The other view, the absence of any physical sexual contact, which is, I think, the more intuitive approach, leaves the process as ethically neutral. But even those who permit donor gametes do so hesitatingly. IVF may be further disruptive than IUI. IUI, sorry, they defined the previous paragraph, is essentially... IUI is to take sperm. That's where the male has trouble in terms of ejaculation. And IUI is basically a medical procedure whereby you take the husband's own sperm and we essentially inject it into the woman's body. There's no donation there at all. It's just a way of ensuring that. IVF may be further disruptive than IUI regarding normal marital relations. In other words, there it's not through a typical act of intercourse. It's through this act of insertion or injection. It is also further removed from association with adultery as third-party semen is not introduced into the reproductive tract of a married woman. By the way, I'll talk about this in the next paragraph. Assuming that sperm donation is acceptable, which most posts can accept, there is a major dispute as to whether we prefer a Gentile or a Jewish sperm donor. Okay, what's the argument in either direction? So the Jewish, if you have a Jewish sperm donor, so then you have the concern that they might, that number one, you could end up with halachically prohibitive marriage somewhere down the line. You don't know about the relation, right? Somewhere down the line, it's arayos. It's, they're too closely related. You also have a, another scenario, which we're going to come back to, which is the case of a Kohen.
I was going to say Kohen.
Right, very good. So you have, right, if you have a father who is a Kohen, right, so that creates a difficult scenario. Let's hold that and come back to it. But that's going to be an issue we'll talk about. Others say that no, that we actually prefer a Jewish donor, and that's based on more mystical grounds.
Right.
For those who are more mystically inside, well, you're taking a non-Jewish soul and you're inserting it into the family bloodline and so on and so forth. So that's sort of this debate. Okay, fine. Anyhow, what about the question, though, our question of PGD? What about the IVF with PGD? So here's a very interesting citation. Tell me what you think about this. Last paragraph. While halakha may see no intrinsic flaw in wanting a child of a particular sex, it does not indiscriminately waive religious prohibitions otherwise in effect to realize this goal. The personal desire, in other words, this is like the designer baby choice, right? Does halakha permit a designer baby? We don't need IVF, we just want it so that we can use PGD to choose the gender. Personal desire to have specifically a son or a daughter does not in and of itself override the halakhic imperative to maintain natural marital relations. Hence, Rabbi Yitzhak Zilberstein, who regularly contributes a response to the Israeli medical halakha group, rejects IVF for sex selection. Normally, God joins with man and wife in creating a child, he writes, but here, it is the doctor's hand instead. Here's the doctor's hand instead. What do you think about that argument?
Does it resonate? Into a natural process.
Interference into him. So it makes sense to you. God created a natural...
Understand it.
Okay, fine.
So I think the goal is to keep it as natural a process as possible.
Okay.
Because I think is part of what you're getting at. So to at least still have the appearance of the magical mystery and that this is an aspect of it is from God.
Mm-hmm.
So, as opposed to selecting it and being it so humanly driven.
Okay. And is God not the part and the one who gave us these tools? Is God not partnering with humanity in the miracle of fertility treatments today?
All kinds of medicine.
Right? Is that not also a gift from God according to Jewish approach?
To me, there's another point.
But I think that... Yeah, go ahead.
Because I'm just going about... Because the whole thing of... No one says you have to have a boy or a girl. I mean, if you achieve that, then, you know, you've fulfilled it. But in the natural course, you might not have a boy or a girl. So that's kind of a big piece of it. Who says you have to go to extreme circumstances to get a boy or a girl when you might not get one anyway? You know, and I think you're sacrificing a lot of other things. It seems to me that I don't see much of an argument for it halachically to be allowed to do that.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it seems very weak.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just because... people in the normal course might not have a boy or a girl, and I don't think anybody envisioned, because obviously we didn't know we could do this, that you have to go to those measures, you know, and it's not something that's guaranteed
right.
For anybody anyway.
There is another, I mean, IVF comes with halachic complications, there's no question about it. I mean, to procure the semen, right, requires, right, some sort of process in which you seem to have hotzaat zera, you have semen emitting that doesn't go directly into the wife. So that's it's not a halachically entirely neutral matter.
Again, only in terms of sex selection, not in terms of medical. If you have a medical problem,
yeah.
You can do anything that you possibly could to have a baby. I can understand that. But the idea of being able to choose could further, as we've seen in certain societies, could further certain prejudices for one or the other. And I think the goal of a humanistic society, I'm not saying feminist, I'm saying humanistic society, mm-hmm. is to develop attitudes of respect and value, et cetera,
mm-hmm.
towards both genders.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that this
you can say feminist also.
Does it make sense?
No, I said you can say feminist also. Right, it's coming from the
same
place.
Oh, right, but I'm just saying that That it's about humanism.
I agree. And you guys should know for the record that I don't know of a single posik who would say that you can choose just for the sake of choosing. I've never seen such a thing. That's generally rejected across the board just for that. And by the way, the opposite extreme, not by the way, to the point, the opposite extreme where it's a question of, let's say, a T-sex baby or something like that, a lethal disease, I don't know of a posik who does not permit PGD in that case.
So
that's very, very important, right? I do not.
If
you know you're both carriers, why don't you, why they would recommend IVF, with PGD. In order to avoid the potential suffering. That is a little bit of a question.
Would they recommend like procedures and things over even adoption?
That is a great question. That's subject to significant debate. Adoption comes with halachic complexities as well, and all sorts of emotional, and other challenges too. So there are many it's a question.
I feel like there's such gravity in either direction. Putting yourself through the process in either way could be emotionally and physically
100%. Those are very difficult decisions, and some posts will make it. Will leave it to be a personal decision as well. Absolutely, but there's a pretty live debate about exactly that question. That's a great point. It's interesting. Adoption isn't necessarily all that common in the Orthodox community, and that's not. There are real halachic issues there. It's not a simple matter. It's a complicated issue.
There was an article
very interesting
that I read this week, and I don't remember which online forum it is. It's about an IVF clinic that has, like, a mashkiach there. So that's the Orthodox community here in America.
Sure.
Might be in New York, feel much more comfortable going.
So did we talk about this at one point?
That sounds really familiar. Somebody
I think we mentioned this class. Machon Pua in Israel trains.
Right.
It's a different kind of hashkacha. Instead of giving a hashkacha, you can give a hashkacha in Acme or in a restaurant or in the lab. Okay? So there are people who are specially trained to do
this. This is this rug with this payas and the whole and this big black hat just standing over that, that whole.
For sure. There are mistakes that are made. There is a debate about this, though. It's not so clear that it's halachically required. But yes, there's a mashkiach for this, too. Okay.
Because women feel more comfortable. Couples feel more comfortable going to a place that has.
100%. And there's some who think that halachically it's required because there have just been one too many mistakes. Yes. So, okay. Halacha, no problem. So those are the two extremes. And in halacha, just for the sake of, for the fun of it, that's clearly rejected, or just for personal preference, for the sake of avoiding a lethal disease, that's clearly rejected. I'm not going to read through the whole thing in the article, but they do discuss, and the post can generally say, and debate some of the middle cases. Right? So, for example, let's say it's the kind of genetic disease in which it only applies to one gender.
Of course.
Huntington's and so on and so forth.
Hemophilia.
Hemophilia is another good example of that. Right. Can you be allowed? Right. Then you would be allowed. The majority of posts can permit that as well. Even if it's not lethal, although Huntington's, I believe, is just at a much later stage of life. And my understanding is that it generally doesn't affect the male until the 50s, and at that point you may have already born children who, unbeknownst to you, have carriers of the same or have the same disease. So it's that. So that's another case. BRCA is a modification. BRCA 2 is a modification on that because men can have BRCA 2, but it's much less common, and it's much less common for them to develop cancers on that basis. They're more likely to get prostate cancer than they are otherwise. But breast cancer, the incidence is much, much, much smaller for men than for women, of course. And it's just simply much less dangerous to be a male carrier than a female. So that might also be. So that's also subject to some discussion.
Do the medical illnesses that would affect being permitted to do these procedures also affect permissibility of
What is that? In other words, because you should prefer IVF and PGD, therefore might be more stringent with abortion?
Let's say you don't know and you end up, God forbid, with a Tay-Sachs.
Yeah.
That you have amnio, and it tells you that it's a Tay-Sachs child.
For sure. That's the case where the Tzitz Eliezer said that you could abort until 3 months or even six. Highly controversial. That was the case where we've said in the past that Moshe Feinstein used to say, go ask my friend Rabbi Eliezer of Oldenburg, because
right,
I can't
right.
get. That was exactly
right,
that case. No, that's fine. That's exactly it. Okay. One other case, certainly Pru Revu is another instance of where the halachic calculus will impact things. That's another case, as we were mentioning earlier, where you might say it's not just about preference for a boy or a girl, actually there might be a halachic cause. But the other one comes up on page 50 that I want to look at, and this is the last case that I want to look at for today. And this is the case of Yichos, the case of the Kohen. Right? So here's an interesting question. I mean, it's obviously not relevant for a secular medical ethicist or a secular family, but for a halachically observant family, it could be highly relevant. Second case concerns a child would not have the same status as a Kohen that the social father had. Okay? So, right, this is a case where you have a Kohen has special public duties and rights in the synagogue within a religious community. It's obvious who is a Kohen, who is not.
Yeah.
Right? Okay? The Aliyot, the Bechakonim, etc. The social father here was concerned that every member of the community would thereby know that the child was not a genetic son, destroying his privacy in the matter. He therefore requested PGD to guarantee a daughter. Okay? Yeah.
Yeah, because they would call him up as a Kohen automatically.
Sure.
Yeah.
Right? So that's who just wanted to have a daughter. And what's very interesting is that the poskim, although they're not unanimous in this, there are many poskim who permit a daughter in this case to avoid embarrassment. Okay. Now, again, obviously, from a purely secular perspective, this is completely irrelevant. There's just no such consideration. But
a secular grandchild could marry a religious
mm-hmm.
person, and then you have to figure it all out.
Mm-hmm.
Is that how it works? Like, you'd have to go back, you know, and figure out, like, whose heritage is what?
It's
the grandchildren?
That's right. It's complicated. If you look on page 51, they point out that... Rabbi Yigal Shafran, who was involved in the chief rabbinate, indicated 4 lines down that in his opinion, it's the case of the Yichos, it's a different case, sorry. In the Kohen case, he thought, another case which we didn't discuss, would be permitted by Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach. The Kohen case presented originally more than a decade ago, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, my teacher, Rosh Yeshiva Yishar, in Israel, gave the following opinion. In principle, the suggested procedure is no more problematic than artificial insemination from a Gentile donor, and indeed is probably less so. Right, and as much as I accept the view of the Matirim, those who permit it, with respect to the latter, I see the proposed procedure as at least equally permitted. Right, in other words, there's no reason to prohibit this, preferring a daughter, any more so than an artificial insemination in general. Given the facts set forth on the technical plane, and as much as in cases of adoption, okay, Samantha, to your question, experience has shown that at some point it is best that a child be told the truth. I have serious doubts about the wisdom of pursuing this course, especially as it's only 50% suffix uncertainty. But I understand the complexity of the issue and the feelings it arouses, and the couple must, of course, decide for itself. In other words, he's saying that he's recommending that they be told the truth of the Yichos one way or another. And again, he goes on to point out, in general, the poskim for emotional anxiety or distress or to avoid embarrassment tend to think that that's a legitimate course. So again, to summarize, as a general matter, actually, poskim come out in a relatively similar place to what most Western ethicists have concluded. Because of concern of designer babies, etc., the extreme case of just a preference, generally, most would not permit. Maybe would even say is usher. The extreme opposite case of avoiding a lethal disease, post can overwhelmingly, if not unanimously, or perhaps even unanimously, permit. In the case of like the BRCA gene and Huntington's, etc., or even to avoid embarrassment, again, most permit. The Pru Urevu case, right, even though there is a halachic argument that is stronger, there's much greater skepticism about it. Because many say, no, Pru Urevu means a mitzvah to do what one can within the realm of that which is, you know, reasonable. And that's obviously subjective for each family and individual situation. And once you've reached that, you know, that you've done what you can, you're not obligated to go, you know, out of your way to pursue extraordinary means. Maybe it's permitted, maybe not, you know, but certainly is an obligation that would not but be what we require. But that's it's interesting that on the one hand, halachic authorities come out generally in a similar place as Ephesus, but there are halachic nuances that impact on the halachic discourse in a way that is unique. All right, so that's that. I just want to say again, because I know people have to step out. Next week, I think I want to start taking, I want to transition to the topic of abortion in halacha. So we'll look at abortion and the discarding of embryos a little bit, but look at that a little bit more fully. And then we're going to transition, God willing, from that to then look at the question of fetal reduction. When you implant all the embryos, what happens when you're trying to have a baby, right? Even if you don't have optimum, right? What happens in a case where there are, right, twins, triplets, quadruplets, and how does halacha deal with this? I've received urgent questions from doctors in this community about these kinds of scenarios. Those are very, very hard questions, and so we'll, God willing, tackle
really
those moving forward as well.
In terms of the health of the mother and the viability of the remaining.
Yeah, absolutely. So
and
we'll talk about all of that.
The child is born with the ambiguous
We can definitely talk about that, sure. Sure, absolutely.